things happen to people who listen to radio.
Once we understand the bug, we will defeat it.
Are you ready for
The only good bug is a dead bug.
Shoot a nuke down a bug hole, you got a lot of dead bugs. All right?
Some say that a live and let live policy is preferable to war with the bugs.
I say kill them all.
Yeah.
Put it on and leave it on.
Welcome to Bug Radio, boys and girls. Monster show this week. We're going to be asking our man in the city, Roland, not his real name, whether the bug is a bandit's best friend. We're talking masks. Who's got the best mask? Can you even get a mask? Stick around for that. We'll also be asking what the end of the lockdown might look like. To talk bug turkey, as always, I'm joined by the Maharishi of Marlborough Grove, Mr. Kieran Monks-Kaufman. Are you still having a nice plague?
No, I won't pretend it's amazing. I don't want to bullshit anybody. I did explore the Olympic Park at the weekend. Still all those signs about inspiring a generation. I think that remains an open question. You know, people like the spirit of 2012. Did a generation get inspired? I was vaguely inspired by looking at that retroactively. Maybe they meant inspire a guy cycling around a now abandoned Olympic site during a plague.
So you were inspired?
Well, I mean, it was just like, you know, if you start looking at photos on your phone or something from before the plague, it can have quite a powerful effect. You know, I only really watched the Olympics on TV, but there was still that sort of vague sense that maybe in Olympic land, everything's still the same.
Yeah, I mean, it is just generally a bit shit now, isn't it? I mean, it's pissing it down. It's my birthday this week, but I can't see anyone. So I'm just in the kind of crash position, basically.
Also, our benevolent hosts at Threads, who are providing a home for this enlightened bug discourse, enormous respect for them. I just got a message from, you know, Magnus Carlsen, the chess player. He's like a prodigy. He's the world's number one chess player.
Oh, wow. But you know him.
Well, I just like got in touch with his agent because I've got an article coming for, you know, When Saturday Comes, the football magazine, about what's going to happen to the Fantasy Premier League.
Mm.
And Magnus Carlsen, the world's number one chess player, was until recently, you know, in the top 10, and now he's about 17. So I was trying to get his view on like how they should decide the Fantasy Premier League table if they can't finish it. And then his dad just got back to me saying that like he hasn't like thought about it that much.
Radio.
So I won't pretend it's been amazing, but I have drawn some inspiration from a couple of sources. One, Albert Camus' The Plague, which is getting thumbed like Billy Ho these days. I think everyone's getting that. And in it, Camus, who's also a goalkeeper apparently, and he said that all he learned about ethics, he learned from football. He wrote that in this town of Oran, which is going through this plague that's the subject of the novel, he talks about how what didn't work for people was thinking about it finishing, people trying to picture the world after the plague, because it just became this kind of mirage that was impossible to grasp. And so it was driving people bonkers. What worked more than that was trying to focus on day to day and not think too far ahead and not to dwell too much on the enormity of the situation, not to try and fixate on the end of the plague. And also tallies with some other cornerstones of culture, such as The Wire, in which Avon Barksdale says, if you get your mind right, you only do 2 days in prison, the day you go in and the day you get out.
I don't know. I did 14 years. Well, yeah, you know, you did you a little stretch, true. But you're still a soldier, right?
Do you agree that we just shouldn't try and think too much about how or when this is going to end?
I mean, it's easier said than done, no? I mean, I'm sitting here in four-day-old Zoom trousers. It's quite difficult to not remember the times when you could go out and see your friends. I mean, I can understand the sentiment, but I mean, I think it just takes quite a serious amount of, you know, psychological brawn to be able to go through with it.
Right. So you've either got to be, you know, a sort of serious gangster who doesn't mind a bit of imprisonment.
I am not one of those.
Or, you know, a finely trained philosopher who can, you know, work through the logic and reason of it all.
And I wouldn't presume to say I was one of those either.
But also, let's acknowledge that not everybody's having a shit time. So let's pay some heed to Steve Cotton and his cat, Frederick Albert Hitler, dubbed Britain's grumpiest pub landlord, says the pandemic is a dream come true because he no longer has to deal with customers. So where is this guy? He's in Devon. I don't know if Devon breeds these sort of characters or is ashamed of Steve Cotton. But it is nonetheless heartwarming to think, I suppose, of people that like pubs but don't necessarily want to have to do a lot of customer service can now just go back to enjoying their pub with their cat that it has such an obnoxious name. The cat does look very sweet, actually. It's a sort of marmalade one. And
you wonder whether the cat actually shares its owner's prejudices.
Probably not. I mean, and this guy Cotton, he plays the piano, although he has invited the media into his pub at least one time. So maybe he's one of these awful people we talk about who just, you know, all they want is clicks.
Well, you'd assume that he owns the pub outright with an attitude like that. This is the sort of person who isn't the greatest fan of the, you know, the old PC brigade.
He probably thinks Farage makes a lot of good points. Why are they coming over here?
Yeah, so there is a good cat, a good one.
Yeah, it didn't deserve to be called Frederick Albert Hitler.
Well, I don't know whether he did. So he now spends most days drinking pints with his, quote, nasty ginger cat, Frederick Albert Hitler, who looks adorable from the pictures, and without the annoyance of having to deal with clients. This is the other thing about this that doesn't really sit right with me. So while he is apparently a misanthrope who doesn't like talking to anybody, he somehow managed to entice this sort of blue chip clientele. So we've got royals, celebrities, artists, film producers, billionaires, Formula One stars and business heavyweights. But Mr. Cotton insists it does not matter who comes through the doors. He is equally rude to everyone and tells all customers to serve themselves. Bollocks.
Yeah, I mean, he sounds like a clicks guy. Cotton, if that's your real name, come on Bug Radio.
Or, you know, at least give us a pint.
Throughout this, there's been this lack of clarity in the area of masks. So our government has said you shouldn't really need them and don't bother. And then increasingly around the world, other governments have said that you should. I remember watching this press conference with some doctors who had arrived from China, and they were expressing astonishment that people were wandering around unmasked. And there may have been good intentions because, you know, if they're essential to medical people, then it's probably important to sort of bullshit the rest of us so that we don't get all over them. I mean, we've already shown we can't be trusted with, you know, baked beans and all those subsistence goods. We would just nick them all. So if that was the case, then fair enough. But at this point, it seems like the cat is some distance from the bag, and sort of pretty consensus wisdom now that people do need masks. So I think this is an area where the plague can offer some opportunities for levity. And some people are interpreting the need for facial hygiene as a sort of Halloween fancy dress party. So you see people dressed up in gimp suits and Batman suits. So this is something that people can have fun with. I think the most common popular mask that I've been seeing so far is the character of Bane in Batman, because he's got this little mask that's like little tubes. I'm not sure how it works exactly. Is there a thing? Like, is it practical or is it just...
There's something that makes him talk really weirdly.
Yeah, okay. Well, like, people like that. And so I've been seeing a lot of people wearing those masks. This genre, the plague doctor, apparently this is real. And it's not just a sort of steampunk... what's steampunk, by the way?
It's like this kind of art movement or sort of party art movement that's based around the sort of Sherlock Holmes aesthetic where there's all sorts of brass and...
like, basically guys that thought like the Victorian age was great.
Yeah.
Apparently out of that movement, or even before that era which it was based on, there was a character, the plague doctor, who would amble around town with some presumably useless medicines, just sort of going up to places, and he would have a beak and some sort of aviation goggles. And then I guess no one questioned it and it caught on, and, you know, that became the uniform. And so now we see, you know, the odd character around town in a co-op, you know, getting their supplies in the form of the very frightening plague doctor.
From that picture, it looked like it would get a bit hot in there. No. It looked like a lot of effort to go to.
But the thing is, it's like a corporate away day. It's like, you know, approved fun that you should protect your facial orifices by any means necessary. You know, so like the more nonsense you're wearing, the better.
But hang on, can he see out of the eyes? Is there a gap at the end of that beak?
I mean, he's got to be aware of what's going on because you've only got a limited space of operation in supermarkets now.
Yeah, you've got to like interact with the cashier.
Yeah, so I mean, it's high risk. But you know what I mean? As in, like, you can't knock somebody for wearing a full body leather nonsense because they're doing the right thing. They're following the guidance. Although it's not even completely admitted that we should be wearing masks. I mean, what's your understanding? Have we been told to wear masks?
I was told that if you wear masks, it won't really help stop you getting it, but it will stop you from giving other people it. But that doesn't really make any sense because doctors are all clamoring for masks. There's a big scandal about how doctors don't have enough masks. Either there's a big difference between the sort of PPE masks that they get in hospitals and the sort of ones that we can get off of Amazon, or they were deliberately trying to scam us into not getting them so that they could get their mitts on them first.
I mean, it certainly wouldn't do any harm, would it? You know, it seems really weird, the idea that if you're keen to stop a transmission from, like, noses, mouths, you know, that having a physical barrier wouldn't have some sort of useful effect.
Yeah, but unless the mask is airtight. You know, there's that thing when you're wearing masks for cycling. Unless the mask is completely airtight and it fits your face perfectly, then apparently it is useless, because all of these fumes and all the stuff that you're trying to keep out of your face just get in around the sides.
Nonetheless, I think you might as well. I think they've been lying to us. And I mean, especially when it turns out that Kim Jong-un is basically fine. You know, how can anyone trust media institutions?
Yeah, I was finding out about some kind of tanky I Love North Korea Twitter, and there's some characters on there.
These leftist criticisms of the DPRK being authoritarian are usually anarchists that say that the strong centralized state of the DPRK was, again, this incorrect method of anti-imperialism. And I want these people to realize that what you are saying is, A, I am a racist piece of shit, and B, I unequivocally do not support self-determination for the Korean people. Just say it, because that's what you mean, you racist dumb fuck cracker.
Yes, it might be an idea to keep her off the labor door knocking and non-eaten.
Yeah, so the common masks are like the guy from Batman, but also there's like a big sort of DIY scene of people knocking these things up, which look quite fearsome, made out of sort of plexiglass, and they're curved and... You know, there's like guys knocking these up in their studios, if they've got studios, or warehouses, if they've got warehouses. And these look quite impressive. So, you know, again, this is stimulating ingenuity. Masks are good. You know, they're making people creative. They're making people good at building masks. You know, everything is in service of the mask. So it's sort of circular, but people are developing a lot of mask related skills. And, you know, I wonder what other sort of masks are going to catch on, like, who's going to be the first to have a convincing likeness of WHO chief Tedros Adhanom?
I reckon it'd be good if there was some sort of league table of masks where the trouble that went into making them was set against their uselessness. So the top one would be the one which had just taken ages and it just provided precisely zero protection.
I mean, it's weird. It's because it's like the transgression of the mask, because normally if you see a lot of goons heading for you wearing masks, you're like, oh shit, am I in for it now? But now you're like, oh, what a great bunch of lads observing the protocol.
Do you think the masks could be abused? Because, you know, there's all sorts of other reasons why somebody might want to wear a mask, isn't there? To carry out dastardly activities.
I mean, I suppose if you spend more than a certain proportion of your life committing crimes and that requires a mask, there might not be any point in taking it off. You just keep it on.
Yeah, I mean, those people are going to be like ducks to water, aren't they?
But there's no doubt that they're a real big commodity right now, more than oil, say. I mean, like, you see these hair-raising tales of international piracy attempts where a bunch of masks start off heading for Germany and then they get hijacked midway through and sent to Alabama or whatever. Like, the mask guys, they're running the game. You know, they've got hotels on Park Lane and Mayfair. And I suppose that goes even beyond the functional models that the doctors want into, you know, the sort of the more zany ones, from the grotesque red lips of the Joker in Batman, say. Probably there's going to be acts of international piracy with the American government, you know, robbing European countries who are going to, like, complain a bit. But, you know, when America does something like that, I think there is the understanding that Europe definitely won't do anything about it. Obviously, America has blue whale syndrome. It knows it's the biggest thing in the sea. So it can come and, like, take everyone's lunch money, and there's not going to be any consequences. Radio,
the best station. You're a ruthless little cunt, Liam, I'll give you that. But I've got no time for grasses. Feed them to the pigs, Errol.
So, Roland, not your real name, you've been covering financial crime for about 4 years.
Yeah.
How much do criminals love the bug?
Well, criminals will always adapt very quickly and they exploit situations very quickly. They're not hampered by bureaucracy and they will seek to exploit any new situation. And that goes for the bug as well. So I would say the bug certainly provides organized crime with a multitude of opportunities to make new money, but also it makes things more complicated for them in some areas just because of the lockdown and because of all the things that everyone else is dealing with. But at the same time, creates massive new opportunities for revenue streams through exploitation, loan sharking, a whole multitude of scams.
Not backing out.
You bet your bollocks to a barn dance you're not backing out.
So say you were a pretty, like, low beast. Say you were a crook, but not an especially talented one, but you still got a pay the bills? You know, where might you be looking to, you know, get your next score?
You would probably go online. You would probably go onto the dark web and purchase some kind of cybercrime kit and start phishing or smishing.
What's smishing, by the way, just briefly?
Smishing is basically sending a text message pretending to be from HMRC and saying, you know, due to the coronavirus, we are giving people a tax rebate. Click on this button or this web link to access the funds. Phishing is doing the same thing, but through email. So you'd go on the dark web and you can just buy these ready-made kits where it just tells you what to do. You can buy a bunch of email addresses. You just start firing out messages targeting people in their home, targeting elderly people, targeting, you know, obviously everyone's affected by the bug and everyone needs, you know, either government support or needs to talk to their bank and maybe is accessing online banking for the first time. And that's basically where you prey on people's vulnerabilities and you target them that way to either give you sensitive information or to just persuade them to send you money. Or
I gotta say, it seems thoroughly disreputable. And I suppose that's part of what makes these people crooks, to prey on the elderly when we know that that is exactly what the bug is doing as well.
Yeah. So obviously the elderly are most vulnerable, you know, in a physical sort of health sense, but also elderly fraud, as it's called in the States, is a massive deal anyway, you know, generally, because elderly people may be more easily persuaded to click on a link or not as savvy as younger generations. But like this crisis basically has given scammers a whole host of new ways of targeting them simply by virtue of the fact that there's a whole generation of people sitting at home
experimenting with new machines.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of people who've been, you know, tweeting about helping their grandma set up some kind of account. And, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing that a lot of scammers would try to take advantage of and exploit. And, you know, if they access banking services for the first time, then, you know, it's going to be very easy in many cases to persuade people to give you their details or to send their money by pretending to be from the bank or, you know, the post office or, you know, any type of services that people might be using remotely. And the other thing, I suppose, is there's been quite a bit of reporting on a rise in pension scams. So obviously the stock market crashed and a lot of people lost money on that. And if you are, say, an elderly person close to retirement, you might seek another way of investing some of that money. And that's again where a lot of people will come up with schemes that are, you know, too good to be true, because they are too good to be true, and then will persuade people to part with their life savings.
Stay off the internet, puffins.
Well, I mean, you know, your bank will never ask you to transfer money, or just before you click on anything, just ask yourself, is this really genuine? And basically, if you don't need to click on it or if you don't need to read it, just delete it.
Every now and then you've got to do something that might not agree with your principles. Basically, you have to forget you've got any.
I don't want to get too kind of information broadcasty, but are there any particularly big ones that you know of that you could describe just for people to watch out for?
Well, if you look at what some of the banks are warning about, right? So Barclays Bank, for example, is warning people about text calls or letters claiming to be from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization, tax refunds from HMRC, NHS goodwill gestures, so charity scams, a link for an app that tracks the virus using an interactive map, campaigns raising money for research into cures or funds for victims, information about hospitals in affected areas, mortgage repayment holidays or rent relief, parcel shipping cancellations. So all these things that people are, you know, obviously people are very busy online in a multitude of ways and obviously interacting with companies and services.
What sort of scams would you advise? Because it strikes me that like this would be a good time to pose as the NHS. Everyone wants to give money to the NHS. Everyone wants to support the NHS. So if I just sort of fire off a bunch of emails from an encrypted address, say, like just saying, you know, I need some more overalls, I need some more masks, sort me a few hundred grand. How do you like my chances?
I mean, there's numerous examples of people selling disinfectants, non-existent face masks, hand sanitizer. I mean, if you really want to get into some serious money, you'd probably get into government procurement. You'd link up with some sophisticated guys who can set up a good website for you or clone a website from an existing organization that actually can legitimately supply masks, ventilators to a certain scale. You know, that's the other sort of major scam people are getting in the act on, which is basically the procurement frauds. And that's really where the big money is. I'll give you an example. Europol put something out 2 weeks ago. I think they got most of the money back, but this is the German NHS, the German health authorities. They contracted two sales companies in Zurich and Hamburg to procure 15 million worth of face masks. And this is kind of where the scam has a good chance of succeeding, because there is so much competition on the market. People need to procure this fast. There are shortages and a lot of due diligence will basically, I won't say it goes out the window, but it's not what it normally is and things are moving fast. So they got in touch with what appear to be a legitimate website in Spain selling them, these face masks, but actually this site was fake. The company initially claimed to have 10 million masks, then the delivery fell through. They then referred the buyers to a trusted dealer in Ireland, and the Irish middleman promised to put them in touch with a different supplier in the Netherlands. They paid for an initial delivery of 1.5 million masks. They paid 1.5 million upfront euros. They said they transferred the money to Ireland, and the delivery was going to involve 52 lorries and a police escort to transfer the masks from a warehouse in the Netherlands to a final destination in Germany. Just before the delivery date, they informed the German authorities that the funds had not been received and they needed another 880,000 euros, which they sent, and obviously the mask never arrived.
I get scammed a lot. You know, I'm kind of a sucker. I fall for a lot of scams. And I feel like now it feels like, you know, the scammers have massively upped their game. They might have undergone some sports training montages. They might be really kind of feeling in the zone. So, you know, my odds are lousy. Probably the best thing now is it's basically scam or get scammed. You know, if you're scamming somebody else, at least you're not getting scammed yourself.
Well, there you go, Kieran.
Would you advise me to start trying to scam people?
the thing is, Kieran, would that fundamentally change your view of the bug? You know, if you start making the kind of money you've never earned in your life, would that actually change your view of the bug in a way that you can no longer continue hosting this podcast?
He's turned the tables on you.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about, you know, the winners and losers of the bug situation.
Because you'll be like episode 11 and you'll be like, yeah, we do not agree with the bug, but, you know, I've got a Bentley now.
People have asked me sincerely whether I would trade losing the bug for losing Bug Radio. So you've either got the bug and this podcast, or you've got neither.
Yeah.
It's a tough call.
Let's be frank, you never wanted my friendship, and you were afraid to be in my debt.
I didn't want to get into trouble.
I understand.
In situations where we've had societal breakdown and people can't get the basics they need, we're reading about how organized crime syndicates are stepping up to bring Aunt Hortense, or if we're in Italy, Aunt Hortensia, her cabbages.
Yeah. Early in the crisis, there were these reports from Brazil that, like, President Bolsonaro wasn't really doing anything. He was in a sort of very Trumpian way, not taking it very seriously. And the sort of favela crime syndicates were enforcing the lockdown. And then we had reports from Mexico that the Sinaloa cartel was delivering lots of food and aid packages to the poor and elderly. You had reports from Italy that in Naples and Calabria, the mafia was doing this as well. So on the one hand, cartels and mafia have been impacted in the sense that they have trouble moving drugs across the US border. And the Italian mafia will also have had lots of trouble moving their drugs through Italy. So they can still get the international shipments, but the other sort of logistics are disrupted. But that will probably be quite short term. Where they will really try to exploit the situation is the hardship. So you'll get lots of loan sharking. Obviously, they'll start to help, you know, handing out food parcels in the poorest neighborhoods. That comes at a price, obviously. So they'll try to extract loyalty. People will be forced to work for them to kind of pay back that kind of charity.
In recent years, it's felt like it's not all going the mob's way. Like, so Martin Scorsese made that movie, The Irishman, and that was sort of widely considered to be maybe his last mafia movie. So, you know, they were probably reeling from that. So is this going to be enough to sort of bring them back from those kind of blows?
Well, maybe they were getting a bit of bad press, but I mean, they're extremely powerful organizations and they are not going to be short of cash, even in this current situation. If anything, they have too much cash and they'll struggle to launder it, basically. So temporarily, things will get a bit more complicated for them. But at the same time, they adapt very quickly. You know, they have the means and they don't have the bureaucracy. So you'll see a lot more companies, you know, small, medium enterprises, which are really struggling, which will be more likely to accept either control or investment of dirty money, basically, from mafia type organizations or organized crime in general. That again is a great opportunity for organized crime. So I think overall they'll be doing well out of this.
Any business who needs access to cash to pay their rent, their salaries, suppliers, or purchase stock will be able to access a government-backed loan or credit on attractive terms.
Lots of British companies are going to be clamoring for some of Rishi Sunak's government support. How many of those companies are real?
Well, the vast majority will be real, but there's a parallel there with the procurement issue where the kind of due diligence is a lot less than it is normally. And in this case, you have like a lot of governments basically saying pay out, check later. So there will be lots of opportunity there to basically abuse the subsidies, either whether, you know, you run a small company, it's loan subsidies and you don't pay the loans and you funnel away the loans, you divert it and then you launder it, or you pay people who then put it in another bank account for you, or you set up a fictitious company just simply in order to get those kind of subsidies. So that is going to be very difficult in a lot of cases to actually check that, simply because the pressure is so great on actually paying that money out, because a lot of businesses are at risk of going under.
I wonder if we might get people changing their criminal habits now that things like burglaries and muggings are more fraught with peril, given the bug and the imperative to distance. So are we going to see burglars and muggers turning to white-collar crime?
I think there'll be more movement online. I think there'll be more cybercrime. And I think that's happening anyway. But I think you'll have more people trying that out as a new way of getting money.
All right, brilliant stuff. Keeping us all informed. And you look after yourself.
Thanks for having me.
Put it on and leave it on.
So I think the curtain twitcher discourse has moved into a new phase, the selfish pricks discourse. That's a phrase that's getting chucked around. You know, the Daily Express, for instance, has been knocking up these photos with gerrymandered depth perception. So it makes it look like there's a very large number of people in a small area when it's in fact not the case. And people have been phoning into LBC saying, you know, somebody's having a barbecue, I hate them. And so this is like a popular form of catharsis at the moment, that people who are trapped with lots of energy that with nowhere to go can do their civic duty by admonishing people that are perceived to be failing in this grave responsibility that we all have in ensuring that humanity has a future. Because I suppose there is kind of the future of our species rests on our shoulders, and you know, it should be eminently doable. But I think there are some shades of grey within this, and people with the best of intentions are at times flouting the regulations. People who fully understand the implications that even the briefest interaction could be fatal. People who read medical research papers outlining the minutiae. When you go around London now, you do see more people. You see interactions. You see people sitting rather than walking. But while it's a simple instruction for people to isolate, to stay at home, it's not simple to follow. So for one thing, the behavioral psychology of going from a life of naturally meeting people all day, every day, to never seeing anyone outside your household for months on end, is sort of mind-blowing and naturally leads to a lot more sort of anxiety and depression and other associated mental health costs. So it goes beyond just loneliness. And then also the physical health costs are less well documented, but we're told that a sedentary lifestyle can be as dangerous as smoking. And of course, many people live alone. Many people won't have work that takes them outside their home. Many people will live in homes that are not safe. So the definition of essential activity is going to be different for different people. And these various tensions are only going to grow as people are kept indoors longer. In theory, resources become, you know, more scarce. There's more flashpoints. Like, for instance, you might have seen these reports that people in the countryside are getting shirty with city rats flooding into their neighborhoods and presumably bringing that bastard bug with them.
Yeah, is this just a few kind of irked bumpkins, or, you know, could we see a proper kind of Wicker Man situation here? I mean, what would you do? What would you do if you were out in the field, you know, husbanding your ruminants, and you saw an oik with a haircut careering across the horizon on a Segway, you know, with horse tranquilizer spluttering out of his nostrils? What are you going to do? Are you going to grab the 12-gauge and jump in the Land Rover and head for the front line?
Is that what justice looks like in the plague era?
Well, I don't know. I guess we're going to find out pretty quickly, aren't we? I mean, is this new? I mean, people in the country have always hated people in the city, haven't they?
Right, but we talked about the bug being a Rorschach test, and it just reinforces everyone's opinions that they had before,
yeah,
but massively underlined and in red letters.
Yeah.
So now the country folk have got a point, because looking at the tables for numbers of cases in different regions of the country, it is striking that, as you'd expect, the more rural, remote areas are a lot less badly affected than the built-up areas where people can't avoid interactions so well. So presumably you can maintain a cordon sanitaire around your little hill or village So if you've got a lot of Herberts just coming in, you're going to think, like, fuck, you know, we've maintained this perfect arrangement. And then there's these villains are just flooding in, as you say, on their really obnoxious sort of pseudo scooter things from Shoreditch. And they're just like, well, sure, why not, huh? Just, you know, make myself at home.
One of your men cross my land or even touch one of my cows or do anything to that store, I'm not going to the sheriff, the governor, or the president of the United States. I'm coming to see you.
Do you think we're going to start to see kind of unilateral checkpoints and borders? And
well, I think what you're talking about is Tony Martinism.
But do you think we're going to see another Tony Martin?
Well, or perhaps a legion. I mean, you know, Tony Martinism as a religion almost.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was just wildly speculating. I don't know what the legal situation is with villages or small towns taking the law into their own hands.
Is the law basically, like, it doesn't apply in rural areas?
Tony Martin was a lonely man who lived in a house on his own, I think. He was constantly beset by burglars. And obviously in the countryside, the rural police, you know, as far as a kind of rapid response unit goes, is kind of a joke. You know, they'll turn up 2 hours later and just go, yeah, shit happens, you know.
Well, it's like home advantage, isn't it? It's like if you're a burglar in Barcelona and you rob someone's bag, you know, the police will look favourably on that. It's similar in, say, Norfolk. If you're a local bandit in, not even a bandit, but say you run a tractor business in Norfolk and you find that, you know, there's all these sort of slick-haired, ambiguous vehicle-riding tossers just sort of cruising in, and all of them have got the bug, and none of them are asymptomatic, and they're all just like, yeah, we'll just sort of enjoy ourselves. And then you blast them to Kingdom Come with a blunderbuss. What rural court is going to convict you?
Do you think they might set up their own kind of like Cree courts like they have in the Australian outback?
Oh, yeah? Is that so? What? So,
yeah, for Aboriginal societies, well, they have different legislative programs for dealing with outback transgressions.
Well, all I'm saying is if city people are entering rural spaces right now, they could have a bad time.
I think while it's true that people by and large aren't machines and they're going to find it more difficult to go through with the actual process of abiding by these rules, I think there are cultural differences between nations and regions, which will mean that it's going to be easier to kind of hold the line in some areas than it is in others. I mean, obviously, some of that has to do with the political setup in different countries or whatever. But just to keep this at home, do we think that the British are uniquely unruly, or are they just sufficiently unruly where any sort of lockdown just becomes practically untenable here after a fairly short space of time, whereas it might be possible in another country where, you know, perhaps people drink less? Or it was a Tory idea, wasn't it? It looked like that was Number 10's initial calculation. You know, look at these British people. We've spent the last 4 years telling them to ignore experts and to listen to Darren Grimes instead. So, I mean, this is not going to fly.
I think the idea that we're unmanageable is flattering. People are finding little opportunities to burn a bit of credit from the Bank of Civic Goodwill and cash that in exchange for a bit of mental well-being. So whether it's reading a book in a park for a bit when you're not close to anyone, or having a conversation with someone outdoors, or maybe having a bike ride with somebody that's not a member of your household. It's like in prison, you can find small outlets, small reliefs, partly as there's some scope for ambiguity with the messaging, and the guidance changes every 5 seconds. So for instance, we were told that we didn't need masks, and now most governments say that we do. And we were told, while most countries were in lockdown, that we could still go to football matches and pubs. And then we were told that the constabulary might inspect our shopping bags for Easter eggs. So you can't blame people for trying to sort of apply their own reason and common sense rather than being sort of strictly by the book. Because, you know, is the book necessarily a better guide than our own common sense and logic and understanding?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things here. Firstly, people, or the British public, are never going to be anything other than a mixed ability group. So you're going to have certain people who are generally quite thoughtful and quite conscientious and are going to be able to come up with some sort of elegant solution to this that enables them to have fun without causing problems for everybody else. And equally, you're going to get some pricks. And the second part of this is that the police, whose job it is to enforce all this, are also a mixed ability group. You're going to have some police officers who are quite talented at kind of community policing. And you're also just going to have some police officers who are just not going to be capable of understanding anything other than the most primitive concepts. That's what ends up with these police officers who are turning up at people's houses and telling them they're not allowed to go into their front gardens, and sending drones out to film footage of people having a walk in the, where was it? Was it the Lake District?
Could well have been.
Yeah. Any group of 60 million people it's just going to be very difficult to figure out where you draw these lines in the sand, how many wankers there are in the general vicinity and what sort of generally wanky things they're likely to do, and sort of make your calculations on that basis.
I mean, I'm always wary of talking about unity because it's a politician's phrase that elides essential antagonism.
Yeah.
So, you know, if Boris Johnson or one of his ministers talks about unifying the country, there's at least half the country that couldn't, if it wanted to, be on the same side of them. I mean, there are these essential antagonisms in society.
Hmm.
But I think it's been striking that during the lockdown, there has been quite perceptible solidarity. And that's the only way it can work. Because, I mean, the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And generally, people have, in most cases, been doing their best to support each other.
Hmm.
So rather than having the sort of Mad Max apocalypse scenario of frenetic competition over increasingly scarce resources, we've had these mutual aid groups where everybody is doing their best to help each other out. And, you know, the NHS's Good Samaritan app gets overloaded to the point that a lot of people still haven't had any missions on it. But this is going to test our relations. If people who feel that they're following this to the letter, and I suppose particularly care workers who are in the seventh circle of hell, you know, for them to see people even minorly flouting the protocols is going to breed resentment. And I suppose people that are in a position to completely follow the rules, because that's not everyone, are going to get pissed off at people they feel are not making the same. Social solidarity at this point means social discipline, first of all, to encourage everyone to follow the guidelines that ensure that, as far as possible, we protect each other. But also an understanding that, like in a prison, people are going to find small ways to sort of keep themselves going that doesn't involve jeopardizing anyone else. The sort of ongoing solidarity as this continues is going to rest on trying to maintain that balance of trying to ensure that everybody follows the guidelines, but also recognizing that if people occasionally fall a tiny bit short, okay, so with due respect to Albert Camus, who says, let's not think too far ahead, we're gonna and think about how things might look after the lockdown. So in parts of China where they've reopened to some degree and people can go to work and use public transport, it's not like it was before. There's still temperature testing and checkpoints and partitions introduced wherever possible. So say a dining table in a workplace would be segmented into four so there was minimal opportunity for germs to cross-pollinate. So let's think about how we might look post-bug. There's some interesting LSC research talking about how maybe there'll be a lot less people living in cities. People will think, you know, the downsides of the city, they were already overcrowding and expensive and pollution. Once you add the bug to that, it doesn't look like such a great deal. And so we'll see more and more people leaving the cities. And the people that remain will deal with a city that's changed to accommodate greater distances.
Is this a short-term thing or what?
Well, I mean, it all makes sense now, as does the idea that they'll introduce new forms of stratification and discrimination based on your relation to the bug. So say you're a pretty young, healthy person who's had the bug and has the antibodies, then you might be able to go to places where, you know, people in higher risk groups would then not be allowed to go.
Assuming that we've established that infection does give you some sort of immunological memory, we don't actually know that yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even necessarily dependent on that. It's just you could make partitions on the basis of people who are perceived as vulnerable or not vulnerable. And in order to have as much of society functioning as possible, you imagine these sorts of decisions will happen. Basically by vulnerability, and that could be either by the sort of factors that people talk about, such as like underlying conditions and age and whatnot, or it could be, depending on how the research unfolds, people who have had or have not had. So there could be a lot of different sort of criteria attached to why some people got some freedoms that others didn't.
What really gets me about this is that if you look at what's happening in China at the moment and the security situation in Wuhan, first of all, how is a kind of instinctive libertarian like Boris going to be able to preside over anything resembling the surveillance and the forced testing and the public monitoring and everything that's going on in Wuhan? And secondly, who does have antibodies? People are saying 10%. Most of the modelling that I've seen is saying between 6 and 10%. Nowhere near enough to end lockdown with any sort of significance. Do people with mild symptoms only develop mild antibodies that don't last long and produce weaker autoimmune response? Angela Merkel says no mass gatherings until late August. But that's tricky because everyone under the age of 60 is absolutely jonesing to just hair out to the pub and just go full Keith Richards until 8 o'clock in the morning. Let's say that we bring in one of these, you know, there's this contact tracing app that people are talking about that's been used in China. I think it's been used in South Korea. I mean, if every single phone automatically force downloads this contact tracing app, you know, on your phone, you have like 4 or 5 apps or 10 apps or whatever that you can't get rid of. So they just get in touch with the carriers and they just say, you need to force every single phone to download this. And it would need to have some sort of way of keeping Bluetooth on as well. I mean, even if that happens, if you're off your nut at someone's house and you get a notification saying you need to self-isolate because you've come into contact with a spreader or whatever, you know, you're going to struggle to book that Uber right then and there, no? Like, if you're really, really drunk. And also, how does this on or off system work?
I guess it's not so much on or off. It's graded. So some people get some freedom. So you open this type of business, but this one is closed.
Are we going to see people like plumbers, for example, or, you know, people who have to go around to other people's houses just in order to be able to make any money? Are we going to see those people just wearing hazmats, standard issue? And if so, do we need to buy shares in hazmat suit and manufacturing companies?
It certainly could be a good time to get in on the ground floor. I think another interesting aspect of how a return might look might be the rise of robots. I mean, obviously robots, you know, they were played out in the 60s, but during the last election, we were knocking doors in Milton Keynes North alongside a very inspiring candidate, Hannah O'Neill, who I will bear lingering ill will to the people of Milton Keynes North for failing to elect. Something that was striking about her was how much pride she took in Milton Keynes North, because she was like, everyone thinks we're all artificial and we only exist to steal Wimbledon's FA Cup. But we're real, we're substantial. And as she was telling us this, we saw this little sort of robot dog thing that was doing deliveries. And she was like, look at that. We're future oriented. We want little robot dogs going around delivering things.
So hang on, they've got robot dogs delivering their shopping. Where's my fucking robot? This is Milton Keynes, yeah?
Yeah, I'm sending you the link now.
Why do I have to traipse up to the shops for my Shreddies and Beaver Towns while these Fauntleroys get waited on hand and foot by Wall-E?
Well, it has been on trial and it's been going furthest in Milton Keynes North for a long time. And
for
now,
a long time? How long?
Well, at least they were still going during the election in December and a few months before that. Henry Harris Berland of Starship, the company that makes the robot, says he's making them available to NHS workers so that they get these little robot dogs who will do their shopping for them.
I guess that's fair enough. If you're in scrubs, you get a robot. That's fair dues.
I think at this point you could get away with more or less anything if you said you were doing it for the NHS.
Yeah.
I'm robbing this bank for the NHS. I'm shorting the pound on the currency markets for the NHS. I'm like drugging a spaniel for the NHS.
Well, that's it.